It is great to be with you. It's amazing that another year's rolled around, but we do start class tomorrow, and I know the Highland Park schools don't start until next Monday, and so all the streets are only going to be partially packed till everybody gets back from their vacations for the school system. I am delighted that the chair of our board, Mike Boone and Marla Boone, are here with us for this occasion. Mike and I do teach a Sunday school class together, and we have a lot of fun doing that. And one way or another, one of us is usually in town, which works out very well. But Mike's been an incredible chair of the board three starting on the fourth one. Craig Hill, our new dean, you're not new anymore. He's now been here in a year. We've got two new deans. He's not even the rookie anymore. But delighted to have him here as a part of this. And it's always good to see Billy Abraham, one of your members sitting over there. You always wonder, what in the world is he thinking? But when he starts rubbing his beard, you think, well, gee, am I in trouble or what? But nevertheless, I have a tremendous respect for Billy Abraham because of his work around the world in spreading the news about Jesus Christ. I'm about to get him well educated. I keep talking to him, I'm about to get him straightened out, but nevertheless, it just shows you there are some accents, no matter how long somebody stays in an intense environment like we have in Texas, there are some accents you just can't break because he obviously still sounds like he's just gotten off the boat. But nevertheless, he is one of our treasured faculty members, and it's always great to have him here. This is the 103rd year of the opening of SMU. Tonight we have convocation at 5 o'clock, and then we meet our new faculty members and so on and start classes in the morning. And so the relationship between Highland Park United Methodist Church and the university, as John's mentioned, has been a long one, and one that I've always been very interested in making stronger, because I think if both of us are strong, then that's additive. And so as a result, it's been a great relationship that I've been able to have with Mark and with Paul, and now with John joining in too. And I'm very, very happy that the Wesley Center is going to be under the directions of this church. We have a lot of campus ministries that are stronger than the Wesley Center, and we ought to not like that. I know I don't. And John Wesley Hart and I used to talk about it quite a bit too, but that this church, I know, with this church in charge of it, it's going to go well, and the future of it's much brighter than it has been. And so all of you that can be helpful in that regard, I know it really would be great and appreciated, and there will be result from it. One of the great things about university is you have two new years, and you have two ends of the year, and of course, the end of the year is in May, and so this past May, we had a great speaker, Dr. Francis Collins, that Congressman Pete Sessions helped us get. But he is the head of the NIH, National Institutes of Health, the biggest health research organization in the world. Before that, he oversaw the International Genome Project, in which we mapped all of our chromosomes and so on, genetic makeup of all of them, and is really one of the world's preeminent scientists. But he's also probably the, or if not the, close to the, most preeminent believer among preeminent scientists. And on Friday night, when he made his presentation before commencement, and then during the commencement on Saturday, he had not only talking about health issues and research issues that he's helping to oversee, but he also had a lot to say about his faith. And his story is a great story, particularly one for our time, and particularly those of us who live in a university environment. He said as he was getting through his education and finished it up in his late 20s, right close to 30, he was an agnostic on a good day and an atheist on a bad day. And that he was really had reached the point that he recognized that secularism just didn't answer all the questions he had about humanity and about purpose and being. And so he was talking to a friend, and that friend, although that friend intellectually wasn't capable of answering all of his problems and answering his questions, he still introduced him to the book, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. That's just a little book. I first read it when I was in college. It's probably 50, 60 years old. But nevertheless, it's still a very well-written and a very articulate presentation of why he believed in Jesus. And Gail and I went through it with a study group just this past year, kind of a rediscovery of mere Christianity. But what Francis Collins said was that his friend's willingness to talk about it, and then C.S. Lewis's enunciation of reasons for his Christian faith, helped him to see that there was a world out there that he really had no idea about. Now, the whole concept that he said helped him to see made me think about the Gospel of John. And in my conversations with you over the years, those of you who have been here know from time to time, like at least every other year, we do something from John, simply because it's a fascinating book to me. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all were written at about the same time, and at the same time in the 50s, 60s, somewhere in there. But 30 years later, after you've had a lot of go over the transom, a lot of Christian believers die, and so you've had to get the oral histories down in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then John, 30 years after those are out, there are all kinds of problems that have arisen. And the Gospel of John is written in a way to address those problems. He doesn't try to give as fair a linear rendition of the history of Jesus and so on, his activities, like Luke does, for example. He has some particular points and stories that he wants to tell. And you can tell that if you go back and look at what was going on with the church at that time, that these stories all relate to the issues that have arisen in those 30 years after the Gospels have been written, and after you have a lot of second and even third generation Christians coming into the faith. And so John is fascinating. You look at Matthew and Luke, and they want to give you a story of the virgin birth because that was important. John, by the time John's writing, that's not the issue. The issue is, what is the cosmic view of this Jesus? Is just Jesus like a Greek person who was resulted from a god coming down and mating with a female human? What is he? And John wants to say, no. This is part of a much bigger story. And if you look at those first 18 verses of the Gospel of John, they are magnificent in what they have to say about the cosmic relationship of Jesus with God and with creation. And so as a result, that's the beginning he wants us to have. But in the second part of that first chapter, it's all about come and see. And that's what got me tied with Francis Collins' comments and that Gospel of John, because Jesus starts calling people to be his apostles. And when they ask him questions, he says, well, come and see. And they always come and see, and of course, become believers and apostles. Philip was one of those he called, and Philip goes and sees his friend Nathanael and says, come and see Jesus of Nazareth, who we believe is the Messiah. And Nathanael says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? You know, it's like a UT person talking about College Station. I mean, it doesn't, you know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And Philip says, come and see. And he came and he saw and was a believer. Now, this occurs over and over again, as you know, we don't get a report of all 12, but Thomas is listed and so on as those who have come and seen and have become followers of Jesus. And those 12 were a motley group. I mean, you get them from A to Z. You've got a person who worked for the Romans, who couldn't be more hated by the Jews than somebody who worked for the Romans, Matthew or Levi. And then on the other end, you've got Simon the Zealot, who was absolutely the force behind, I think, always trying to get Jesus to take over and to be a military leader and to oppose the Romans. So you got that list, that span, and then you've got everybody in between. They're all there. If you want to remember them, the way I remember them is that I had a song from Sunday school and Vacation Bible School that was a song of the 12 apostles. And so if you're ever trying to remember them, just remember that song. I know all of you learned it, right? At 8 o'clock, you never know if they're awake or not. but there was one good sister out here that knew it, and the rest of them didn't. So at 9:30, my family came, and of course my girls know it, and their kids know it, and so I got a great response from that, but we're gonna go through it. You ready? Jesus called them one by one. Peter, Andrew, remember it, James and John. Philip and Bartholomew, doubting Thomas and Matthew. We're going to have a remedial class on this, I can tell you. And then James, the one they call the less, Simon, also Thaddeus, the 12th apostle, Judas made, thank you, Judas made. Jesus was by him betrayed. There is a song for the books of the New Testament, but there's 27 names for it. I think we need to get by the apostles before we try that, but it's helpful to your memory of everything too. But look at the three, there are three of those 12 that have names associated with them, identifiers. James, the one they call the less. Can you imagine being called the less? The best thing would be if he were short, but the general understanding is that he's called the less because James, the brother of John, was so dominant until he was the first one to be executed. And then you had James, the brother of Jesus, who really was the leader of the Jerusalem church after he had his encounter with the resurrected Jesus. And so James, the one they call the less, tough. Then doubting Thomas. I mean, that phrase, doubting Thomas, the song has helped in that regard. But of course, if people don't know the song, I don't guess that's the reason people think doubting Thomas. But doubting Thomas is a phrase we use. If somebody's skeptical, you say, oh, you're a doubting Thomas. And some of the people that say that have no idea where it originated. But nevertheless, doubting Thomas. And we know about Judas, so we won't say anything about Judas. Well, he betrayed Jesus, but doubting Thomas, if we look at the places that is described, there's only one, and what we'll see is that Thomas, in many instances, was just speaking for everybody, but he's the one that got the label. But let's look at Thomas a little bit. Now, if you go to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, other than his name being a list of the apostles, which you're going to learn how to say, his name, other than his name with the apostles, he's not mentioned. He has no script in those three gospels. But if you look at John, you'll find that Thomas is all through John, and that he has three scripts in John, and that there must be, as I said about the Gospel of John to begin with, there must be a reason. John is using him for something, or believe me, he wouldn't be in John. John is preaching little vignette sermons, but he has some themes that go through them. And so Thomas got to be important for what John's trying to do. And so let's look through that, because I think it explains at some level how he got that doubting Thomas. Susan read that scripture about it that we'll get to in a minute. But let's look at the three times that Thomas has a script and try to determine why it is that John is using him in such an important way. The first one of those is in John 11. And if you want to put these on, it says sermon notes. You can put it on the back if you want to look at these later. But John 11. Now in John 10, there are two instances in which the Pharisees and scribes work up mobs to try to stone Jesus. And they're mad at him because he's claiming to be the Son of God. And so they're going to stone him to death. And these 12 apostles, not only are they to learn from Jesus, but very quickly their job comes to protect him. And I've not seen a movie about this, but if I were staging this movie, I would have these 12 really worried about it. And as they start picking up stones, somebody, one on one side and one on the other, grab Jesus and away we go. You've seen this from other leaders. When something occurs, then whoop, they're gone. And I don't know whether it's Peter and Thomas or who it was, but they get Jesus out of there. And when they did this time, they fled on the other side of the Jordan in hiding, more or less, but they also knew that the temple guard couldn't come get them over there. The Romans could go get them, but right now the Romans weren't mad at him. It was the temple guard that was after him. And so as a result, he's over there. They hardly unpack till they get word that Lazarus, his good friend in Bethany, which is just right outside the Jerusalem wall, that his good friend Lazarus has passed away. And so he says, we're going back. And all the apostles say, are you kidding me? We just got you out of there. There are people over there that want to hurt you. We can't go back. And he says, we're going back. And there's this one phrase there, this one sentence that Thomas has. He's the only one quoted in this, but it is very enlightening to what was going on in his mind. He says, if he's got to go back, let's go with him and we'll die with him. Now, that gives you a sense of the fatalism that Thomas is beginning to feel, that this, what we got going here isn't going to have a good outcome. And if now's the time, well then, if he's insisting on going back, let's go back. It's also clear that they really don't know what this is all about, what Jesus is about. They just know that there's some people that are going to kill him, and Thomas is a faithful follower. Thomas believes in Jesus, believes in what he's doing, and to the extent that he understands it, which isn't a lot, but he's devoted to him personally. And he doesn't want anybody hurting him. And if he can't protect him, he's willing to die with him. And so let's go back. And if they get him, we'll die with him. You know the story, how he goes back and he raises Lazarus from the dead, and you would think that that would really convince some people that Jesus is who he says he is. But the ones who are really interested in the politics of all of it simply go to the Jewish leaders and say, well, he's back. And not only is he back, he's doing tricks that people are believing. And so the Sanhedrin gives a death warrant. They basically empower people to go get him, and it's best, as their leader said, that one should die rather than the whole nation get destroyed by the Romans. And so go get him. The word gets out, the 12 apostles grab him up, and they take him out to the desert, and it said right on the edge of the desert, a place called Ephraim. And so they're there for a while. But wouldn't you know, Passover's coming up. And so Jesus says, we're going back. They go back for Passover, and when they go back, he enters on what we call Palm Sunday. And so he enters Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. He spends the most of that week in preaching to others to get them to believe in him, and also in comforting his apostles. And so at the last dinner, what we call the Last Supper, the night he was betrayed, we have Jesus becoming despondent, because obviously he knows what's about to happen. And he's very distressed. And as he talks about being distressed, it's upsetting the apostles. And so Jesus says to them, I'm going away. Where I'm going, you can't come now. You'll be able to come later, but you can't come now. And I mean, the apostles, you can just see, I mean, I'd have the idea, good grief, you got us into this. Now it's about to fall apart and you're leaving and saying we can't go with you? What's going on here? And Peter says, no, Lord, I'm not waiting. I'm gonna go with you. And even if I have to die with you, I'm coming with you. And Jesus says, no, Peter, you can't go now. But in the beginning of the 14th chapter of John, there are three verses that we read at almost every Christian funeral, because it's what Jesus said to comfort his apostles because he's leaving them. And these words have been very, very helpful for millions of people as they are getting used to having to leave the dear one that's been taken from them in terms of their deceased. And so you'll recognize these words, but it's the first three verses of the 14th chapter of the Gospel of John. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. But I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you with me, that you may also be where I am. You know the way to the place I'm going. Now, we usually stop at 3, but he adds 3 more verses. One of them being, I'm going away, but I'll come back, but you know the way where I'm going. And Thomas, I'm sure speaking for everybody, says in verse 5, we don't know where you're going. So how in the world can we know how to go, how to get there? And Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. So the apostles need some information. They feel like they're about to be abandoned. They don't know what's going on, but they do know that he's leaving. And it's sort of like the nuance that was in what Jesus was saying, well, I am the way. You know, when you're scared to death, or when you're really frustrated, or when you're really anxious about something, nuance kind of goes out the window. You can't hear it when people speak it to you. You can't really think through it at that time, because what you need is concrete evidence. What you need are concrete statements, facts that are going to happen, and here's how they're going to happen. And so this went straight over the apostles' head. There's hardly any way that they could understand it at the time. And for Thomas, evidently, it was just sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. But he is speaking, obviously, for everybody. We don't know where you're going. And you got to know where before you know how. And we don't know the way. And so, what's going on? And other than what Jesus says here, and you can tell they think, when he says, well, when you see me, you see the Father, and so now you'll know that you've seen the Father. And they're going, it's your time to ask him the next question. I didn't get any answer on this. And so later on, of course, they go out in the garden. Soldiers come, Judas leading them, and the rest of the apostles just scatter because they're afraid they're about to be grabbed and executed like Jesus is going to be. We know that John and Peter have some follow-up, but we don't know where Thomas goes. But we do know on the Sunday that Jesus arose from the dead, that evening they were, all 10 of them were in a house. That is all 10 except Thomas, what Susan read in that long scripture. So Thomas isn't there. Jesus, but the other 10 are hearing that Mary Magdalene and the other women have seen the resurrected Jesus. And that gives them a question, because in Jesus' whole flip of the last, the women who had the least amount of standing before the law on something like this. So in Jesus' usually way of doing that, the women are the ones he appears to, not the leaders, not the apostles, to those who've taken care of him. They hear that story. They hear about the 2 on the road to Emmaus. Jesus appears in the middle of them and confirms his resurrection, but Thomas isn't there. And so, you know, you'd say, well, where is Thomas? Good question. Where is Thomas? It could be he's afraid that all of them are going to be there. They've got the door locked. They make that clear. They got the door locked because they're afraid somebody might come in on them. But Thomas isn't there. It could be that fear. It could be the fact that he is so frustrated about the situation, that he was so upset with the fact that all of this was coming down and it didn't end up where he thought it would end up. It didn't end up how he thought it would end up. And so he was just frustrated with the whole situation. That might be why he's there. But fortunately, some of the apostles evidently during the days after that talked to him about it. And I don't know if they didn't meet together until the week later, but what John says is a week later, which would be the Sunday after that, Thomas is there. And maybe they say he came last week on Sunday, maybe he'll come this Sunday, but for some reason Thomas was there. And Thomas has already told him, I'm not going to believe anything until I see it. And they said, but we saw it. Thomas said, it doesn't matter. I need to see it. And so as a result, somehow he's there and Jesus appears to him. And then what I think is one of the key elements of John's whole gospel, Thomas says, my Lord and my God, when he sees him, ruling on earth, ruling in the universe and in heaven, God. He says that, and Jesus says, blessed are you because you believed when you saw, Blessed are those who will not see, but will still believe, who won't have the opportunity that you've had, but will still believe. And now you can see why John has used Thomas throughout his gospel, because Thomas personifies the individuals who are having trouble accepting Jesus because they haven't seen his body and they haven't seen any evidence of his resurrection. They have only heard the stories. And so here John has Thomas coming through with this. Thomas is doubting just like they are. He wants evidence more than anything else. He wants evidence that Jesus has done it. And Jesus said, I'm glad to give it to you. But let me tell you, the people that I really appreciate are those who won't have this evidence and will still believe. That's who John is talking to in his gospel. The last time we see Thomas, he is with Peter, James, and John, and Nathaniel, and a couple of others, fishing. And Jesus comes out to them, and I won't go through the story, but they eat a meal together, and Jesus makes them fishers of people. You're going to be fishers of men, fishers of people that into the future. And we all know from church history that John and Peter went west, but church history says that Thomas went east. He went to Persia, what we now would call Iraq and Iran, and on to India. And there's a story that the Portuguese, when they sailed into India in the 1600s, found a church that traced its lineage back to Thomas being there. And supposedly Thomas died by a sword being stuck into, a spear being stuck into his side, so that he died like what he wanted, proof that Jesus had died. Now, whether that's true or not, it makes a good story. Now, what are we to decipher out of this? Two things just come to my mind. One, I think we underestimate the number of people who are willing to come and see. That they have their doubts and various things like that. We have to know them pretty much, pretty well, before we're going to know that's there, that they've kind of come to the end of the road in terms of what secularism can provide to them, or whatever line of thought they're going through can provide to them. And they need some friend, like Francis Collins had, who may not can answer it, but he knows some people who can. And so he directed him to C.S. Lewis and Mere Christianity. I know of a lot of times that The Reason for God, Tim Keller, has done the same kind, played the same kind of role for people who want answers. But there are people out there who need someone that they respect enough because of their life that they're willing to come and see either the Jesus they can tell them about or the one that they can point them to. Second conclusion out of this story for me is that I don't know what all Jesus did in those 40 days. John says he did a lot of other things and was seen by other people. He says that right after the Thomas story, which means he thinks he's made his point when he tells the Thomas story. And Thomas, Jesus says, and blessed are those who see and believe without having to physically see me and my wounds. But all of that to say that those, and in those 40 days that we know about, are people, particularly by John, are people who somehow or another could have left Jesus because of what they had done or what they had thought. And so you see Peter in the 21st chapter of John. Peter has denied three times, and so John reports Peter getting a chance to affirm his belief in Jesus three times, just one after another. Peter gets restored. Peter goes on to be the leader we know about. We got Thomas. He was willing to come to Thomas to provide what Thomas needed to be able to go forward. Judas took himself out. He did not make himself available to be restored. And can you imagine if Judas had? We'd probably have a letter from Judas or a gospel from Judas or something other. He was there. But Judas was of the mindset and so on. He evidently didn't have enough commitment to Jesus at all, obviously through his betrayal, to show up again. afterwards. And so one of the things I think we can learn from that is that all of us have, we all get disenchanted. We all get disappointed. If we're interacting with humans, there's no way in the world we're not going to be disappointed. Sometimes offended sometimes. Get somehow out of sorts with the local congregation or the church, the denomination we're in, or the church universal. And so in our angst and in our disappointment and in our offendedness, what do we do? Well, one thing or the other, you either separate yourself or you make yourself where you can come to some kind of resolution. And in those situations, I'd suggest four things. First, if that's you, don't isolate yourself in a bunch of cynical unbelievers, because cynicism is a disease and it will work on you and make you much more miserable than you were coming in. Don't isolate yourself in an intensive group of cynics and unbelievers. Second, that when you are in a situation like that, try to make sure that you get the right comforters. Judas got the wrong comforters. He went to be comforted by those that he had made the deal with, and of course, they laughed at him. And if you expect sympathy from those who don't believe themselves, then you won't get it. Go to the right comforters. Look for some way that people that can help you deal with your situation. The third, know that Jesus is looking for you. He found Peter. He went to Thomas. The scripture says he's knocking on the door. In John, you've got the blind guy who gets thrown out, and it says Jesus is looking for him. And over in scripture, you find those who are in times of distress that Jesus goes looking for. The lost sheep, 99 in, one lost, Jesus goes looking for him. One of the main images of Jesus in the Gospel of John is that Jesus is looking for those he can find or those who might come and see. And whether he comes to you in a person, in mere Christianity, or whatever else, just know that Jesus hadn't given up on you. You might be questioning whether he's given, whether you're going to give up on him, but he has not given up on you. And fourth, and the final one, get with people who either have been through the same thing you have or read the books of those individuals. They're individuals who have walked in your shoes. And read those kinds of things that can help you in that regard. If you're the one trying to help somebody, again, do those same things and be helpful to them so that those four components work out right for them. Being on a university campus is a wonderful existence. But you've got all forms of belief, all forms of unbelief. And individuals that go up and down in how they're related to their levels of belief. Like Thomas and like Francis Collins, we need to be there like the apostles were for Thomas and the friend was for Francis Collins, that we can help people come and see. And if we're the one, that we don't just disappear. That in those times of difficulty, show up. Make yourself available, because knowing that it's when things are available to happen that good things can. If you just disappear, they can't. May God bless us as we try to help others come and see, and that we ourselves, when we need somebody to help us come and see, that we show up. God bless you.